Hello, and welcome to Sobercast, where we provide AA speaker meetings and workshops in podcast format. We're an ad-free podcast, and if you enjoy listening, please help us be self-supporting by visiting Sobercast.com, look for the donate link, and drop a dollar or two into our virtual basket. We hope you enjoy the podcast. Have a great day.
Hey y'all, my name's Camille, I'm an alcoholic. I'm so nervous. My sobriety date is October the 7th, 2013. I have a sponsor who has a sponsor, and I am willing to sponsor women. I grew up in a great home. I was the only child. My parents divorced when I was about 13. And that's when I really started drinking. I don't remember exactly who I was with or where I was when I had my first drink, but I do remember when I took that first drink that I didn't like the way it tasted, but I continued to drink it anyway, right? So I should have known I was crazy back then, but drinking and drugs are a huge part of my story. I didn't really believe I was an alcoholic until I got in these rooms. But for a long time, drinking worked for me. I was 13 when I started. I graduated high school. I went off to college, and the people that I partied with and drank with, I counted myself way different than any of them, because I was in college, and, I was smarter than all y'all, and I was able to hold my stuff together, if you will, for a long time, right? I went on to, I graduated college, and I went on to graduate school. I got my master's degree, and so that just continued to give me that, oh, I'm better than attitude. But there came a point to where I just really lost control. I had a job in the banking industry, and due to my drinking and drugging, I would call in, wouldn't show up on time, or wouldn't call at all and just show up when I was ready. So they let me go from that job. Yeah, imagine that, right? So I was devastated, of course. I've never been fired from a job, and that was one of the reasons why I was so different from all of you, is because I was able to hold all that stuff together. So I was unemployed for a while, got another job, really good job. I loved that job. And I was in outside sales for about 3 years. And things just got worse. I wouldn't show up for appointments. They would call and ask me where the hell I was, and I wouldn't answer that phone call. So eventually I went to work one day, and I was in the doctor's office, and I was selling to these nurses, and they could smell alcohol in my breath, and I hadn't slept for a few days, so they decided to email my boss a letter, and I was eventually fired from that job. And that was devastating to me. So then I had the choice to get some help or get worse, and of course I got worse because I wasn't an alcoholic, I'd never been to AA in my life, and I definitely didn't want to label myself as the same as all these people I partied with, right? So without a job, somehow I still had to afford to drink and get high. So, I took the high road. I decided, prostitution wasn't really a good thing. So I wasn't gonna do that, So I did what I thought was the better, high class criminal activity, and I had access to personal information of people, and I decided that identity theft was the way to go. And so, yep, that was me. So, Yeah, so I did lots of crazy stuff while I was involved in that because my obsession was to somehow figure out how I was going to afford the next drink. So it got that bad. I applied for credit cards in people's names. I mean, I was printing money. Yeah. You know, had to have money to get your alcohol right. I was doing a lot of crazy stuff, you guys. So, and a lot of that stuff, I'm going to have to make an amends for. But, yeah. So it got to a point. I didn't realize I was this funny. Y'all are awesome. So, there came a point to where a detective got involved. And so, I basically, you know, I didn't know what to do. I knew there were several nights where I would sit in my apartment and I wanted to quit. But I didn't know how. And I think I finally came to that point to where I knew if I was going to quit, I was going to need somebody else's help because I had pretty much, you know, made a train wreck out of my life. So with the help of, you know, my lovely mother and my attorney, they suggested I go to detox, right? So, and I'm from Savannah, so I went to a detox in Savannah, and for some reason they decided to keep me there for 3 weeks. I guess I was pretty, pretty batshit crazy. So, I knew I needed long-term treatment. So, they decided to send me to a halfway house here in Atlanta where I still reside today. And I'd never been to an AA meeting, never been to an NA meeting, none of that. Didn't know what I was getting myself into. But I knew, I mean, I was lucky enough to realize that I was powerless and I would do anything you guys recommended me to do. So at the halfway house, they told me to get a sponsor and I came to this meeting and there was this lady up here telling her 50-minute story and I was like, yep, that one's my sponsor. So I went up to her afterwards and I think I said something to the effect of, you know, you don't have any choice. You have to be my sponsor. And she took me in and, you know, she told me we were going to start reading the big book. And, she also told me that, you know, she was going to take her only day to sleep in to read the big book to me. And I thought, what the hell kind of loser is this, right? You're not sleeping in to work with me on the big book. But she did that, and we started working the steps, and some of the most important steps to me were step three. We sat back here, and I got on my knees and did the third step prayer. Step four was really interesting because, you know, I wanted to be thorough. You know, I didn't want to mess up. So I had all these pages of all these resentments. And writing all that down on paper, I really realized that, you know, I was judging others in my addiction, but I was really wrong. I had been wrong the whole 20 years of my drinking and drug use. So, that was eye-opening, and we sat down together and spent several hours going over that damn list, and I felt better, and we did six and seven, and step eight, write down all the people that I need to make an amends to, and, you know, I've made amends to mostly family at this point, and they're a little bit more gracious, I think, than some of those others are going to be, but I have the privilege of making amends next week to one of the guys that I stole his identity. So that should be really interesting. So let's see. Step 12, you know, carrying this message to other alcoholics. I don't have any sponsees yet, and I think that must be where the miracle really does happen. because you get to see people like me come in all beat up and screwed up, and then we turn around in some way, and that's got to be a miracle. So I can't wait for that. So what it's like now. Oh God. So what it's like now. Well, you know, it's way different. There's a line in the Big Book that I read every day, and it talks about we don't run around foolishly trying to arrange life to suit ourselves. And that was me. I mean, I tried so hard to fix what was wrong with me, and I just couldn't do it. So with the help of you guys, this home group, my sponsor who got me connected to a higher power, has just been amazing. You know, now I pray instead of like cussing at the printer because it won't print right, you know. So I spent a lot of time unemployed while I was, you know, getting sober and learning what this deal was like. And so I finally got a job. And I enjoy going to that job, and it's crazy, but I think the people there actually like me. You know, I haven't called into that job. I show up on time. And I do the same thing with, you know, with you guys here. You know, if I say I'm going to greet, I'm going to greet. And by God, if I say I'm going to stand up here and talk in front of you guys, I guess I've got to do it. But it's, life's just a lot better than it used to be. I feel a little bit more calm, and sometimes I don't know exactly what to do with that. So, but I have you guys to thank, and oh my God, y'all, thank you so much.
My name's Kathy. I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is Christmas Day, 1989. For those of you doing the math, I was six. I am a member of relatively long-standing of the Toco Group. I have a sponsor, and she has a sponsor. My sponsor has 35 years in this program. So, and in the Toco Group, I am a baby, which is what I like about that group. Okay, I want to thank, is it Mike? Dave, whatever. I want to thank Dave. And I will say to all of you here, sorry, all, I'm even shorter than I thought. I will not say anything nearly as important as what he said when he said he went out, thought he could have a couple of drinks, take a white chip, and get right back in. I've never relapsed, but I have in my years heard people say that same sort of thing, where how hard it is to come back. And that scares the bejesus out of me. And so if you hear nothing else tonight, what you heard from him was the most important thing you could possibly hear. One of the things, this is not AA approved literature. Did I pull up the right page? No, I didn't. Oh, well. Oh, yeah, here it is. Okay, the marvel of AA is that I tell only what happened to me. I don't waste time offering advice to potential newcomers, for if advice works, nobody would get to AA. All I have to do is show what has brought me sobriety and what has changed my life. So, what it was like. The longer I'm sober, the more I realize just how bad it was. I didn't really, and I will tell you, first let me say, I was a daily drinker, and once I picked up a drink for that day, I could not stop, and that is a blessing, because I did not have a doubt when I got here whether or not I was an alcoholic. I didn't think, it never crossed my mind, I'm going to go to Alcoholics Anonymous, learn how to drink like a lady, and everything will be fine. That never crossed my mind, because first of all, I never drank like a lady, but secondly, if there even is such thing. But secondly, I knew to the, my very core that once I picked up a drink, I could not stop. And I've always said, if I had been a binge drinker, I don't know that I ever would have got here. Because I would have had those periods when I had stopped. I didn't have those. I knew I was an alcoholic. So for me, the first part of the first step, well, I don't want to say it was easy. It was, I came to this program knowing that was the score for me. What I had more trouble with was the unmanageability part. Didn't really buy into that right away. Because, you know, I hadn't lost a lot of stuff. And I always say, I have a very boring story. I didn't have a DUI. I didn't own a car. I wasn't driving. I lived in Chicago. I'm Irish Catholic from Chicago, so I come by this disease honestly. My house growing up, my father had built it. We had a wet bar. Didn't everybody? I mean, I grew up in this milieu where everybody had started drinking every night. And you had your own bar in your house. I mean, that's the way it was. I didn't know any differently until after college, because I also went to a university known for its Irishness. Let's just put it that way. So I grew up in a milieu where you drank, you had your cocktails before dinner, and then maybe some after dinner. My father would be overserved on a lot of occasions, and he was what you might want to call a functioning alcoholic. So that's what I thought things were. I didn't drink in high, you know, I wasn't one of those ones who thought, oh, I'm going to, you know, we had a wet bar. I never thought of drinking that alcohol. It never occurred to me. What am I going to do that for? I was an overachiever in high school. And then I went to college. Guess what? I went to a college full of overachievers. I was a not quite good enough overachiever in a university full of really overachievers. So what does alcohol do? It takes you out of where you are. It says, just like Dave said, it's I'm good enough. Because sober, I wasn't good enough. A few drinks in me, I was good enough. You know, several drinks in me, I was bulletproof. So I learned early that that's what alcohol could do for me. Now, I wasn't a daily drinker in college, but I was a drinker and I had the GPA to prove it. But, you know, I got through. I got out of, I drank in college a lot. I thought everybody had black. I didn't know till a year and a half sober, this honest story, I did not know till a year and a half sober that not everybody had blackouts. I heard somebody say that, you know, they drank and then they had their first blackout and that really worried them. I thought, what are you talking about? You know, wasn't everybody? It had never occurred to me while drinking that perhaps this drinking to blackout stage was something not everybody did. But when you're in college, that's kind of the, you know, oh, ha, ha, I don't remember what I did, blah, blah, blah. The thing is, other people grow out of it, and I didn't grow out of it. So, you know, I'm out of college, I'm working, doing the same, you know, you go 5 o'clock on a Friday, and you all hit the bar. Now, I can't remember. Did I get drunk every time? I don't know. I don't remember. I just know, you know, by the end, I drank every day in my own house by myself. Oh, yeah, by the way, there was a marriage and a divorce in there, too. Yeah. By the way, that might have had something to do with the first marriage not working out. But, you know, I digress. So, but the point is my story is not, there's no DUIs. I didn't go to jail. I didn't get fired. I didn't, you know, I didn't do any of that stuff. I had a divorce. Who doesn't? But, but it, you know, but does that mean I'm? Does that mean I, you know, I wasn't? I'm not an alcoholic. I didn't have. No, you know what? Because for me, it is about why I drank, what it did to me, and how I felt. You know, by the end, it was that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. That perfectly described where I was. And the whole thing about, you know, I suffer from the, or you know, I used to more, but I'm on the depressive end of the scale. And for me, it was a matter of, I don't want to live anymore. I'm going to drink myself to death. That was a conscious thought on more than one occasion. But I had a copper spaniel who I knew couldn't live without me. So, I didn't quite, forget the human race. They could live without me. But the copper spaniel, maybe. So, I didn't ever, but that's why I drank. I drank, by that point, the fun was gone. I was isolating myself a lot. My life was spiraling out of control in a very quiet kind of, just a really quiet way that nobody else really saw, but I knew was happening. And realized I had, like it says in the book, I had lost the power of choice. There wasn't a, and it talks about that you can't bring back to mind the humiliation of even, a week, a month, a day. You can't bring that back because you've gone right back to that obsession has hit you and you've got to have that drink. And for me, it even would be in the mornings, I wake up shaking and I'd think, well, I just didn't get enough sleep. I don't think that was quite the problem. It might have been, the whole, I wasn't drinking the good stuff by the end. So the Gallo brothers, I kept them in business. But at any rate, so for me, it was about this quiet desperation, this horrible fear of, I am going to be a bag lady on the streets of Chicago, and, that's where your mind goes. It's, you're not thinking correct. Who knows? I might have been. So, at any rate, so I didn't have, by this point, I'm living alone. I didn't have anyone there to kind of say, whoa, you're drinking a lot. I put myself in rehab. And what happened, and this is where, and Dave talked about it, where there's somebody watching out for you. I could go into, this happened and that happened, and, I didn't get assaulted, and there must have been a higher power. There's all that stuff. All the women in the audience know all about that. I won't go into that. But I was Irish Catholic. You don't talk about AA and Irish Catholic family. So it never occurred to me to just go to an AA meeting. Literally never occurred to me. In the Chicago Tribune one Sunday, there was a big, in the lifestyle section, the front page of it was all about this woman's alcohol rehab program at a hospital 2 blocks from my house. So, there's things get your attention, and then you kind of take the article and you put it in a drawer somewhere. And I don't know, maybe a month later or so, here was the thing. You know what it was for me, too? The demoralization came from because I was disappointing people a lot. And I was disappointing myself, but I could live with that. I don't matter. But I was disappointing other people. I was letting people down. And that doesn't even go into, I was letting my family down for a long time. I didn't care about that either. But I'm an architect, and a friend of mine is an interior designer. He was doing a restaurant renovation. He needed somebody to do the drawings for him and sign the drawings. So I was to meet them at the restaurant space and walk it with them and blah, 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 blah. It was about 10 below in Chicago that day. I went for just one drink before I went to meet them. I was an hour late with several drinks in me, and they weren't happy. I think I got fired right on the spot. But in any event, it was just, you don't do that. And I don't, that's not who I am. I don't do that, but I did it. I didn't, and I was at a meeting this morning, and we were talking about some stuff anyway. This woman talked about how she kind of knew that her drinking had gotten out of control because she realized that her values were educating her children, alcohol, cigarettes. And, she would take care of her children, but then and when the alcohol really took over, she just would give them, carnation breakfast bars for dinner. Well, for me, there was one day when I came home and I decided I would rather drink than feed and walk my dogs. Now, for people who know me, that's not me. Because my dogs are my everything. And, there's these little things that happened that just kind of went, whoa, that's not me. This is not who I am. So, you know, I see this article. I put it away for however long. I go over there, and finally one day, because this little incident, and I thought, no, this is not who I am. You know, I can't control this drinking. I tried to stop by myself. You know, I always tell this because, of course, it was the wine glasses. If I didn't have wine glasses, I wouldn't drink, right? So I took the wine glasses. In the divorce, I got the Cocker Spaniel in the wine glasses and nothing else. So I threw out the wine glasses. That'll solve the problem. No, I now had tumblers full of wine. Even more. There's more you put in a tumbler than in a wine glass. So, I mean, I did all that control drinking, and it was to no avail. So, okay, so fine. I put myself in rehab. I go there to talk to them. I don't know. It might have been like, you know, 24 years ago, right now. It was right after Christmas, because I literally didn't stop drinking on Christmas. So anyway, I go, I talk to them, and they say, okay, you have to come in immediately. You're an alcoholic. And I said, I can't come in right away. I have to get things in order at work, and then I'll. And they had that reaction. Yeah, sure, we'll be seeing you again. I said, I'll be back New Year's Day. And I did not drink. I did not. And it was gone. The obsession was gone. I went to my bosses, and for some reason, I didn't worry about, should I do this again? I just knew it was the right thing to do, and I don't know about you all, but when I just said to you all, I'm from Chicago, if I say fix it, shoot me right between the eyes. Okay, so there is a point, you reach a point when you know I need to do this, and there's a calmness that comes over you and assuredness, and I went to my bosses, and I said, I'm going to alcohol rehab. I will be gone in 3 weeks. And they said, good. We didn't know what was wrong, but that explains a lot of things. And we'll see you when you get back. So I didn't get fired. It didn't cross my mind to, oh, I can't go to rehab, I'll get fired. Blah, blah, blah. I just knew. I just knew what to do. So I did. I showed up on New Year's Day. Now, a hospital on New Year's Day is not fully staffed. So I go there. I say, here I am. They say, have a seat. An hour later, I'm still having a seat. Now, I don't know why I didn't get up and walk out. You know, again, it didn't cross my mind to get up and walk out. It's just when you know, you know. This is where I need to be. So fine, eventually after I go say hello again, oh, we forgot about you. Okay, so then I put me in the detox room with another woman who's evidently, now that I know about this stuff, she had been in, she was going in and out and trying to get her kids back. And she said, are you reading the big book? I'm like, what's the big book? Didn't they give you one? No. So, you know, all this stuff, I had to sort of claw my way through. I had to really prove to somebody up there that, yeah, I'm serious. I am going to do this no matter what it takes. No matter if I have the opportunity to walk, I'm not going to walk. If I have to ask, what's this, what's that, I'm going to do it. So that's what I did. And I was in rehab only for 14 days because the medical insurance company decided I wasn't sick enough because I wasn't physically, since I had the alcohol was starting to leave my body a week before I actually got there because I had to get my affairs in order. Anyway, so they said, okay, 14 days are up, you're out, which scared the bejesus out of me. But so what do you do? You leave. And so there I am. In the big wide world, trying to be sober. Now is when it gets hard. So, you have to get a sponsor. I got a sponsor. And I know that they say, oh, look for somebody who has what you want. I just looked for somebody. And I will say this in the kindest way I can. I had a wacko for a first sponsor. I mean, this woman would call me and say, what should I do? wait a minute, I'm the one 2 weeks sober. But I didn't, at that point, what I'm trying to get to is I didn't even at that point know how sick I was to say, wait a minute, I'm the one who's doing, you know. I didn't, now almost 24 years later, can I look back, and I'm only in the last couple of years, starting to see just how sick I was. You know, it's terrifying. It's a miracle that, it's a testament to this program that I never picked up another drink because, you know, I was a sick puppy and didn't know it. I didn't buy, you know, like, okay, so I go to meetings. My very first meeting was on New Year's Day at the Rehab Center, and it's full of women. And it's in Lincoln Park in Chicago, full of yuppies. Do we still use that term, yuppies?
Yes.
Okay. So they're all like me, right? Well, no, they're not like me. They're all talking about doing the cocaine and going to work doing this. And it was like these, you know, my story was very quiet and small. They were like, whoa, these big, you know, spiraling out of control and public view kind of stories. So in my mind, we didn't, we're not the same. It didn't occur to, you know, so I'm doing this now. I'm doing this comparison and thinking, oh, I'm not like them. But again, you know, my higher power protecting me, I was doing this comparison, but I never once thought I didn't belong here. I knew I belonged there. I just didn't necessarily connect with the unmanageability part. So for me, I'm almost like, and I'm sure there's others, but you hear people talk and they're, you know, they have these lives and there's car accidents, there's jail, and there's broken marriages and they're having fights and da-da-da-da-da-da. And they don't see that alcohol's a problem. Okay, well, here I am. I see alcohol's a problem, but I don't see that it's affecting my life. I'm just seeing I drink too much. So, you know, I stop the drinking and everything will be fine. No, everything's not fine because, you know, because it's a disease of the mind. It is a disease, you know, I don't think, react, whatever, like a normal person. So I had to really, it has been years for me, sometimes quickly, sometimes slowly. It has been years for me to really, 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 really start to understand in my innermost core just how manageable my unmanageable my life was. And I can't even begin to say, well, because of this, it was unmanageable, and that, it was all, you know, I wasn't paying bills, but you know, that's your normal. It was just unmanageable. I was a person I didn't know anymore. I was doing things I didn't know, you know. And I would love to say, I got sober, and then within the first year, that all changed. No, it didn't. And it didn't for me because of me. Because I was thinking, well, my life's perfectly fine. I'm just not drinking, you know. I was one of those ones. I didn't drink. I went to meetings, probably went to two, maybe three a week as a young sober person, which is dangerous. And I had this wacko sponsor. I stayed sober on fear. I'm not recommending it. Don't anybody get me wrong here. I stayed sober on fear, going to the meetings I went to, and I'm a prayer. Now, I'm a prayer. And I had to relearn all that, too. I'm a prayer because I'm Catholic. I know which saint to pray. You know, I couldn't figure out, though, which saint you pray for to, you know, which novena is it? I had a connection with a God of my understanding, a higher power. I had to though, stop asking for stuff and start listening. So I've always been a prayer. I've always thought I depended on something, came to discover later, maybe not as much as I thought I was, but so I managed to stay sober, but I was miserable. So a year and a half in, and I tell you that only because it got to the point for me where a year and a half in, I sat in a meeting and I said, if it hurts this bad, I'd rather drink. And I said that from the bottom. That was probably, you know, the first time in a meeting that I was as honest as I could possibly be. So that was a turning point for me. You know, this whole, this is how I feel. And something's not working here because I'm miserable. Well, what wasn't working was me. You know, I wasn't doing what I knew I should be doing. So I got a different sponsor, and did more things as far as getting more involved in groups and making, saying this is my home. But that was another thing. That's a very, for any newcomers, have a home group. Have a place where they know who you are, and when you're not there, they notice you're not there. For me, I went to meetings. I wasn't going to meetings. I just wasn't going, I was going here, I was going there, wherever was convenient at that time, not making a commitment to a home group. So nobody, I was invisible. I was invisible in the AA program. You got to really work to be invisible. So, so I got a home group. I got a different sponsor. And then, since I wasn't doing, the best work one could possibly do as a young sober person, because by this point I'm seven, my work life wasn't going so well. They were glad when I went into rehab, but I'm still continuing to show up to work late and, maybe not the greatest employee. So, I had the opportunity to come down here on business. So I took the opportunity rather than the opportunity right into the unemployment line. So I come down here. I'm down here for like six. It was supposed to be a 6-week stint. I'm down here for 6 months. And I ended up meeting my husband and meeting down here and eventually moved back down here. So here I am again now. I'm about 3 years sober now and I'm moving to Atlanta. Oh, guess what? Gotta find another sponsor. Gotta find another home group. Oh, yeah, and you can bet I just jumped right on that, didn't I? Oh, yeah. Yeah, that took a while, yeah. And for me, I will tell you that for me, that is hard because I'm not a people person. And if you hear people say, well, if you have to, give a talk, show everybody naked or in the underwear or whatever, say, I'm just, you guys are a room full of dogs. And this, that works for me. I got a schnauzer over there and a boxer, and so I'm happy. But people scare me a lot. I'm painfully shy. And that's why I drink. So for me, the fellowship, everybody goes off to the fellowship. That's been really hard for me. And it's been even harder? Dialing the phone. I was a drinker dialer. I only called people when I was drunk. I didn't care to talk on the phone other than that. And then in my job, before they had email, I would be getting calls from the contractors, as I was on the phone all day long. And you think I wanted to go home and talk on the phone more? No! I'm one of those ones, just because it's ringing doesn't mean I got to answer it. The fellowship part, the reaching out part is really, really difficult for me. Really difficult for me. But I get to a point where it's that or die. I will say, this sounds, I don't know how it sounds, I'm just going to say, for me it's not even do that or drink. For me it's do that or die. Because I know if I drink, I'm not drinking because I think I can have one and come back. I'm drinking because I want to die. Because that's where I was before. I never thought I know the score as far as, can I ever, have one and be fine? Can I ever, he thought he was just going to have a sandwich. Remember that part of the video? So, I know I'm going to drink because I want to kill myself. So, it's not an option for me. It is just not an option. And I hear people say, oh, it's always an option. You just have to make the decision. And that's true. So for me, I have made the decision that is not an option for me. I don't know how else to say it. So when I would go to meetings when I was younger, here's what I mean about I didn't realize just how screwed up I was. I would go to meetings my first couple of years, and everything everybody said, it just made no sense to me. And I'm a fairly intelligent person. But there, I didn't know what they were saying. They would say these words, and the sentence structured, and it was like a foreign language. And then somebody said, I don't know how this works, but it does. Ooh, was like, Eureka. That's all I need to know. That is all I need to know. Dave was talking about figuring out who is God. You know, I think we do. I do this intellectualizing of everything. No, you know what? I don't know how it works. It just does. That's all I need to know. I know if I do X, Y, and Z, it's gonna work. I am going to be okay. You know, if I find myself starting to get in the spot that I don't want to be, and I say, you know what, Lord, God, higher power, whatever I'm calling them that day, if I say, you know, show me what you need me to do, and I move on, guess what? Eventually, I am shown what I need to do. So, you know, for me, it's very simple. I don't get real, you know, intellectual about it anymore because I've figured out I can't. I'm not smart enough to figure it out. So, you know, for me, it's a matter of I don't drink. I go to meetings. When I'm asked to do something, I say yes. Sometimes I'm here. I pray on not only a daily. I'm one of those ones. I think, you know, my higher power's probably gotten the Bose sound deadening or whatever earphones I have. Because I am just chatty Cathy all day long, especially when I'm not doing so good. And it's that's where I go. I'm like, okay, you know, why is this? And it's not always nice stuff. I also heard something very valuable in the meeting once, which is where I hear most of the valuable stuff. My God's big enough for me to get mad at him. You know what? Because there are some days I am pissed at him or her. You know, I'm just not happy. And you know what? It's okay. It is okay to say for me, to my higher power, I don't like this and I am mad about it. But that doesn't mean I'm going to act out on it. That doesn't mean I'm, you know, I am wrong. But that doesn't mean that, you know, I have to act out on it. Now, sometimes I do, but more often than not, you know, I catch myself. So I guess when I think about what it's like now, is the fact that I don't act out on things that I used to as regularly as I used to. You know, I'm total honesty here. I got my moments. So I got lots of them. But, you know, for me, I was thinking when Eric asked me to do this, I thought, you know, what is my sobriety all about? And I can boil it down to two words. Surrender. Surrender and humility. And I'm not saying, oh, I'm so humble. What I'm saying is, if I surrender on a daily basis to doing what I need to do, what I think I'm supposed to be doing, that's automatically, you know, entering into the idea of saying, I don't like this, but I'm going to do it because it's what I'm supposed to be doing. And as long as I do things with humility, as long as I take my ego out of the equation and, you know, do whatever it is I'm supposed to do to the best of my ability, I'm a lot happier. And if I'm happy, other people are happy for starters, but also, I'm not going to go to that place where I want to kill myself or, you know, I want to drink. So a lot of my sobriety, it's that simple. It's just it's surrender and everything. It's, you know, I don't like the way my job's going right now. Guess what? Not a whole lot I can do about it right this minute. So I just have to surrender to the process of what it is, take my ego out of it, and do what seems to be the next right thing. That was another thing, too, early in sobriety. I didn't understand, you know, again, trying to figure out what's the next right thing. So I had to move it to just do the next thing. I had to make it that simple, because if I'm trying to figure out what's the next right thing, you know, and I'm new to sobriety, I'm trying to figure out the right thing, oh, that's dangerous. Because I obviously didn't know the right thing up till that point. Why am I all of a sudden going to know it now? You know, I'm not going to know it now. Yeah, and I could call somebody and say, what's the next right thing to do? They don't know either. You know? I just find if I keep it really, really, really simple, it works better. I had the this whole plan that, you know, I had a roadmap, which you would have enjoyed more. Well, here's the second step and this and that and da 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 da.
Yeah.
I didn't do that. But let me just tell you the other thing. Okay, so what I didn't not necessarily buy into, but what I didn't recognize in myself when I got here was the selfishness and self-centeredness and the fear that dominated my life. Oh, man, filled with fear. And that's what I mean by only now later am I seeing just how bad off I was. I was just filled with, well, first of all, I was pretty sure I wasn't selfish and self-centered because I was a doormat, you know? And how could I possibly be selfish and self-centered? I'm doing for everybody else all the time. Well, you know what? There's a lot of different ways that selfishness and self-centeredness manifests itself. So, again, all I can tell you is I was. And I have to keep that in mind that, you know, I got to watch for that because that's where I'm going to go a lot. I'm going to head right to that selfishness and self-centeredness. You know why? Because I'm scared. And I'm, if there's anything that kind of, you know, describes how I operate, I'm scared. I am scared 95% of the time about something. And when I let that fear be what's driving what I do, then I can't find the next right thing. Then I do the self-centered thing. Then I do the selfish thing. And then I do the thing that makes me not be the best walking big book that anybody's ever seen. You know, it's, I have to be so conscious about how fearful I am. And I always knew, you know, I'm shy, so I always knew I was fearful, but I just didn't understand just how much that fear permeated everything I did and everything I said and the way I reacted and the way I looked at life. And so when you're living in all this fear all the time, you're being a doormat. You know what you are? You're the perfect victim. So another thing, you know, it's like resentments. Oh, I don't have any resentments. Okay, I might have resented when I got to A. I might have resented the ex-husband a little bit, but, you know, that was about it. I was sure of that, that was my only resentment. Yeah, not so much. So, you know, then I kind of swung the pendulum the whole other way because, you know, doing a fourth step, and we need to be resentful about people. Well, you know, when you're a victim, it's easy to be resentful. Just resent everybody because you are the victim. And, you know, I have managed to swing it back a little closer to the middle. You know, we've all heard about it. Part of our MO is, you know, we only see the moderate middle ground as we're swinging from one extreme to the other. And, you know, so, and that is my story also, but I, you know, through working these steps and through coming to meetings and through saying things in meetings like, you know, if it hurts this bad, I'd rather drink, I can get rid of the fear. And if I get rid of the fear, I can get to a place of spirituality because, you know, that's, it says in the book, and I don't know much, you know, I'm not a book quoter as my old age, I can't remember things I read anyway, but this is a spiritual malady. So, and it's like the insurance company was telling me that, you know, you're not sick enough to be here 14 days, but you have a spiritual malady. Because I do. I will not react properly to life if I'm under stress, if I'm not doing what I'm supposed to be doing. Because that's how I'm wired. And, you know, it's something I know, and so it's something I need. It's my responsibility to do something about it. It's not the responsibility, you know, of my parents because, you know, they did X, Y, and Z when I was growing up. And it's not the responsibility of my boss because he can be a murderer. But, you know, it's my responsibility. It's my choice to choose how I react to things. And I couldn't do that before because I couldn't see what I was doing. I can only see it now. I can only see it here after this many years, after doing work, after talking to people, after hearing other people say things. So, I'm trying to think if there's anything else. You might get out of here early. I know I had all kinds of really important things to say. Here's the last thing. I am lucky enough to drive the perimeter every day. 7 or 10, however far it is from here to Perimeter Mall, takes an hour each way. So I will listen to AA talks a lot in the car. And I heard somebody say, you know, the sixth and seventh step for me when I was early in sobriety were kind of a letdown. You know, you do this work, you talk to somebody, and then you go and you sit and you take an hour and you review it. You know, it's like, is that it? And then I heard on a CD, I have to stop saying tape and showing my age. I heard on an 8-track. You know, what the seventh step is just saying, you know, higher power, direct my thinking, show me what you would have me do. And that, for me, is what I try to make my daily mantra. Because I don't know what to do left to my own devices. I don't know how to figure it out left to my own devices. There are some times when I'm in the thick of things at work, I can't pick up the phone and call my sponsor. I mean, you know, sometimes you just can't. So I will say that all the time. This direct my thinking, show me what you would have me do, gets me out of me. Very important for me. Get me out of me because, you know, I'm selfish and self-centered. When I'm in me, that's all it's about. Forget the rest of you. There's not even any dogs out here. These are empty chairs when it's about me. So I have to turn outward. I have to look outward. And when you read the non-conference approved literature, the 24-hour book, there's several days in there when it talks about look outward, look upward. So if I look outward and look upward, things get better. And it's, for me though, I can't do it unless I say, show me what you would have me do. So for me, the sixth and seventh steps, particularly the seventh step, is very important. It's really, really important to me. I mean, I've heard people say, you know, the 10th and the 11th and da-da-da-da, and that's good, but that's like the beginning of the day, the end of the day. I do okay the beginning of the day and the end of the day. It's when I'm in the day that I have a problem. So show me what you would have me do. Now, it's up to me then to be aware, to be awake, to be aware, to be listening, to be seeing. What is it you want me to do? And a lot of times it's what I don't want to do. And as long as, but you know what? You got to do it. The same guy in this disc, you know, he in particular was asking, something about not smoking. And, you know, one of those crazy things we do. And he would hear his higher power saying, just stop smoking. He'd say, no, not that. Tell me what kind of smoke so I don't get cancer. You know, I mean, this is like, you get the answer and it's not the answer you want, so you keep asking, well, give me the answer. So, you know, it's my responsibility to hear what I'm supposed to hear, to be aware of what I'm supposed to be aware of, to do what I'm supposed to do. And if I do those things, the only way I can do those things is if I keep me out of it, then I'm okay. And that's it. Thank you.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the podcast. Sobercast is ad-free, and we'd like your help in order to keep it that way. So if you'd like to help us be self-supporting by pledging $1 or $2 a month, visit Sobercast.com and look for the donate links. Thank you very much.